Biden administration was talking about that they're going to support Netanyahu if they want to attack Hezbollah. Then they said that they're not going to be there helping them. Right now, they're talking about that Netanyahu is going to attack Hezbollah in the coming weeks. And what's your understanding on the Biden's policy in Gaza right now, considering what's going on with him in this 2024 presidential election?
Well, Biden's hamstrung. On the one hand, he recognizes that the United States is paying a horrific price for supporting Israel, that we're losing credibility around the world, nations, especially at a time, again, to bring in BRICS, when BRICS is challenging the hegemony, American hegemony, with a multilateral model, and challenging the United States in the developing South, to say we're the better model, don't go with the United States. This is critical because the United States is trying to mount a challenge to China in the Pacific, the ASEAN members. When they look at the United States, they're looking at a nation that has no credibility anymore, that's lost, doesn't stand for anything. And increasingly, the BRICS model is looking like the better option. This is devastating for American foreign policy. But on the other hand, the extent to which the pro-Israeli lobby controls politics in America today is manifest. And so Biden can't afford to walk away from Israel or to be seen as opposing Israel. Look at the debate. I mean, basically Donald Trump said that I'll enable Israel to kill more Palestinians when I'm president. Implying that somehow Biden is holding Israel back from the committing genocide. Neither one of those postures is going to do America well on the international stage, but domestically, that's what counts right now. And it's Biden's great vulnerability that he is being perceived by the pro-Israeli lobby and the voters in America that are responsive to that lobby as being soft on terrorism, soft on Hamas, soft on Hezbollah. But Biden knows one thing, at least his administration knows one thing, that if Israel goes into a full-scale war with Hezbollah, Israel is probably going to be destroyed, that it's the end of Israel. Israel can't survive that fight. Hezbollah has the ability to blanket Israel with accurate long-range missiles from head to toe, from left to right, that Israel can't shoot down. Now, moreover, if Israel aggressively strikes Lebanon in an effort to knock Hezbollah out of the fight, Iran will join the fight. And again, Israel's not ready to deal with that, that this becomes a war of existential survival for Israel, immediate existential survival. I mean, Israel's already in an existential struggle in the long term because Israel's become an unsustainable concept of a nation. It just can't function viably over time now because of what it's done and how it's positioned in the world. But if they invade Hezbollah or they attack Hezbollah, invade Lebanon, this will accelerate the process of Israel's demise. And the Biden administration knows that. So they're doing their best to try and convince Israel not to attack. But here's the problem. This isn't about Israel. This is about Netanyahu. This is Netanyahu's personal ambition. This is Netanyahu insisting that his legacy not be one of a failed leader, but of a successful leader, a leader who stood up for the security of Israel, not a leader that that betrayed the security of Israel. Without a war in against Hezbollah, Netanyahu will find it difficult to remain in power. And so we're at one of those impossible situations where everybody knows, the Israeli Defense Force knows that if they go to war against Hezbollah, that they will lose that war. They know this. But to challenge, here's the real problem, to challenge Netanyahu could create the conditions for a civil war in Israel. Because if the military challenges civilian leadership, that's a fundamental split from past practice. And then you will see that there will be elements, the West Bank settlers, the far right will rally behind Netanyahu, and we could see fighting in the streets. Even before the Hamas conflict, remember, there was already significant domestic unrest against Netanyahu because of his desire to bring under control the judiciary in violation of the basic laws of Israel. Israel has no constitution, but they do have basic laws. And this put hundreds of thousands of Israelis in the streets. And it got to the point where the president of Israel said that there's a real risk that Israel will fall into civil war, not civil conflict, not civil unrest, civil war. That implies organized formations on either side fighting against each other. Well, if you had the potential for civil war prior to October 7th, you have the potential for civil war today. And that's one of the reasons why the Israeli military isn't doing what it must do at this point in time, is to stand up to Netanyahu and say, no, we're not going in there. Because to do that could create a civil war where radicalized reserve units of Talmudic scholars who are 100% behind the genocidal policies in Gaza face off against more professional units that recognize the futility of trying to win a war that can't be won. And the Israeli Defense Forces acknowledge they can't beat Hamas. Hamas is an ideology. You can't defeat it. They can't defeat Hezbollah. Not only is it an ideology, but it's also backed by a military that in many ways is much more professional and much more prepared for the future conflict than the Israeli Defense Force is. So Biden's in an extraordinarily difficult situation right now, because if he does what's right and doesn't back Israel, he could lose part of the Israeli vote, which, or the pro-Israeli vote, which will accrue to Trump at a time when, you know, the elections are already very close. The last thing Biden wants to do is give Trump even more advantage. So he wants to hold on to the pro-Israeli constituency in America. But to do that, you can't stand up to Netanyahu. What he really needs is a way to get Netanyahu out of the picture so that more rational players come in, so that Biden can enact more rational policy without paying the political price here at home. But so long as Netanyahu's prime minister, genocide in Gaza becomes the only policy the United States can support, and expanding the conflict and against Hezbollah likewise is a policy position the United States has no choice but to support, or else Biden loses the election.
But it seems that they're serious that they want to attack Hezbollah. If they go there, if they start fighting with Hezbollah and the United States just perceive that they're losing, what would be the reaction on the part of the United States?
What can the United States do? There's nothing the United States can do. What, are we going to bomb Hezbollah? How's that working with the Houthi? American bombs, American fighters. We're the best in the world. We can impose our will on anybody. Can't oppose against the Houthi. They wear damn sandals and they're kicking our ass. All right. The Houthi had defeated the United States Navy. We sent one carrier battle group in, couldn't do anything. We're sending another one. It won't do anything either. So what are we going to do against Hezbollah, which is a hardcore trained group of professional fighters? Not a damn thing. There's nothing we can do. What we can do is lose ships. Because the Houthi have old school missiles, old school capabilities. Hezbollah has cutting edge. And, you know, there's that old saying, fool around, find out. They don't say fool, but I'm respecting your audience by not using a bad word. But mess around and find out. If America messes around against Hezbollah, they're going to find out. And you're going to find out a hard lesson. And the United States Navy knows this. We know this. We know that it's an impossible battle. But what we have to do is be seen as supporting Israel. One of the things that we're hoping would happen is that by saying we would support Israel against Hezbollah is that Israel would say, well, then there's no need for us to go to war against Hezbollah because Hezbollah can be contained. But what Hezbollah has shown is that it can do anything it wants to do against Israel, that this war of attrition, this war of escalation is being managed by Hezbollah far more effectively than it's being managed by Israel. Israel's suffering, horrific losses in terms of manpower, equipment, etc. The defense barrier that they've been building for decades, worth hundreds of billions of dollars, is being dismantled and can't be replaced. This is a humiliation for Israel, and this is why Israel politically has to be seen as doing something in response to this, because they can't continue this war of attrition, this escalation, because Hezbollah is in charge. Hezbollah is dictating the outcome on the battlefield. Israel's only hope from their perspective is to go in with overwhelming force to finally defeat Hezbollah. But Hezbollah has been preparing for that for years. Israel will not succeed. Hezbollah has a counter. The United States was hoping to tell the Israelis, don't worry, America's got your back. You don't need to go all the way in. But now Israel says, we're going in anyways. We want you with us. It's a trap, a political trap. Netanyahu knows America better than apparently Biden knows America. And now the United States is in a trap because we promised to support. Now, if Israel goes in and we don't support, we're seen as betraying Israel. It's a horrible situation. Netanyahu's the problem. Frankly speaking, the best thing the United States could do is take him out himself. Literally at this point in time, just tell the Israelis, we no longer recognize him as your leader. We're not going to do business with him. We want him gone. Finish him. Get rid of him. We want somebody else. We can't do business with him. We'll close down the embassy. We'll close all support. But Israel, ruled by Netanyahu, he'd be gone that quick. That'd be the end of Netanyahu. But if we don't do that, Netanyahu is openly bragged about how he can manipulate the United States, et cetera, openly bragged about how he bought Congress. Netanyahu will just play America better than Biden can play America. And in the end, it'll cost Israel everything, and it'll be humiliating for the United States.
When it comes to the conflict in Gaza, Scott, if Trump wins, he was talking about Israel, the situation and the situation in Gaza. He said to them, it was a Israeli media, he was telling them that you're losing each and every country in the world. That's why you have to stop doing this. But we have been hearing the same thing before Donald Trump getting elected. And he was talking about Syria and why we are in Syria. We have to take out our troops. We have to do this. We have to do that. We didn't see anything coming out of those policies. And we had the same policy. Bernie Sanders was talking about these things, and he changed a lot. Each and everything that he was talking about just changed. But when it comes to Trump, that is so important right now, he has a very good chance of winning this election in 2024. How do you see his policy in Gaza if he wins? Is he going to get along with Netanyahu? We know that there are some sort of disagreements between Netanyahu and Donald Trump, especially when he was leaving the office and he had some sort of problems with Netanyahu.
America's not a dictatorship yet. When Biden ran for election last time, 2020, he promised that he would change America's nuclear posture. He said that he wants it to be a posture that's premised on the notion that we will only use nuclear weapons if we're attacked by nuclear weapons. He promised it. He said that the current policy of preemptive nuclear force in a non-nuclear environment is grossly irresponsible. And he was right, but he didn't change it. Instead, he put forward a new nuclear posture of the United States that cemented in preemption and in some cases strengthened it. His representative, senior arms control official in the State Department, speaking at a reunion of intermediate nuclear forces treaty inspectors and negotiators that I participated in, was asked why this didn't happen. The answer was the interagency isn't ready for it. Now, what is the interagency? When I was in government, the interagency was a process used by the National Security Advisor and the National Security Council to coordinate policy directed by the executive amongst the various departments and agencies. And they would send representatives in and they would coordinate amongst one another. That's legitimate. That's how government's supposed to work. But now it's morphed into something called the interagency. What is the interagency? Did you vote for it? I didn't vote for it. No American voted for it. Nobody knows what it is exactly. It's just there. It has many names. We call it the establishment. We can call it the swamp. We can call it the deep state. But it's there, this blob of unelected civil servants and military professionals that are running America and making policy for America. They're connected with the media. They're connected with academia. Take a look at Georgetown University, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, the feeders of people into this system and how the system has taken over those institutions so that critical thinking is no longer tolerated. You have to buy into the templated model of behavior as a student, graduate, and then you are plugged into the interagency, into the establishment. Donald Trump may very well win the presidency. Who does he have to fall back on? Was Mike Pompeo anything other than the interagency, the establishment? Was John Bolton anything other than? Donald Trump doesn't have the Donald Trump Academy of civil servants to say, okay, I'm going to pick these people. He's going to have to pick people that come from the establishment. And so the establishment will own him from day one. Now, he has claimed that he's going to come in and fire everybody in the establishment that disagrees with him and replace them with people that he handpicked. But where are they coming from? Where are the people he will handpick come from? They're just a different flavor of the establishment. There's no new thinkers out there. There's no critical thinkers out there. All the critical thinkers have been starved out, strangled, killed, wiped out. When I say killed, figuratively killed. But anybody who's in a position to influence policy today has been consumed by the establishment. They belong to the establishment. So Donald Trump is higher than a kite to think that he's going to come in, snap his fingers, and make things happen. That's why nothing happened under his old administration, because he snapped his fingers and they went, nope. You remember when he ordered all troops out of Syria? They didn't leave. They increased. Why? They lied to him. They just played games. They shuffled people around. They're the establishment. You know, it's a British comedy series. I think it's a Minister or Yes Minister or something of that nature. Very funny comedy series, but the whole notion of it begins with an election and a new minister is appointed, and he comes in and he has to deal with the permanent civil service. And you just see how he wants to do things, and the civil service ensures that it never gets done. Why? Because they don't want change, because they have the system they're happy with. Ministers come and go, but the blob stays the same. That's the same thing in America. It doesn't matter who the president is. Vladimir Putin hinted at it when he talked about, you know, presidents can promise the world, but as soon as they become president, men in dark suits and dark ties and briefcases come down and sit down and talk to them. And suddenly they're told there's the way that it's going to be done. And your way isn't that way. So that's the reality. Donald Trump, the one time he tried to deviate significantly from the will of the establishment was on North Korea. And he got stabbed in the back by his Secretary of State and his National Security Advisor. Because the establishment's not looking for new policy, innovative policy, successful policy. The establishment's looking for policy that sustains the system that's been in place to enrich them, politically sustain them, and economically enrich them. And that's what Donald Trump is going to run into. That's the danger of being attracted to Trump. Because one, he's a fundamentally flawed politician, fundamentally flawed. He doesn't have good ideas. He has dangerous ideas. People think they're good ideas because there are ideas that are different from Biden, and they hate Biden right now. They were different from Hillary, and they hated Hillary. But they're not good ideas. He doesn't have good ideas on arms control. He's going to take us to World War III. He doesn't have good ideas on how to deal with, you know, Korea anymore. Fire and fury might be his go-to action. But his ideas are going to come in and be articulated to an establishment that just doesn't want to hear them and isn't prepared to do anything about them and is going to let them drown as they will drown. He only has 4 years. He's going to be a lame duck the moment he's elected. So, you know, that's the reality. That's the harsh reality. Nobody wants to talk about it. All the Trump supporters are going to hate me forever for what I just said, but it's the reality of it. How's he going to drain the swamp? He can't, because he doesn't have an instruction manual. The instruction manual he does have is written by the swamp, and it leads you down artificial paths. But at the end of the day, you get tied up, confused, and nobody's there to support you. Who is going to be Donald Trump's Secretary of State? I'd like him to articulate that right now. And even if he picks somebody like he did last time with Rex Tillerson, how is the State Department going to support an outsider like that? Because the State Department is the blob. Are you going to fire everybody in the State Department? Which he claims he might want to do. Who are you going to replace them with? People who graduate from Donald Trump University? No. So, you know, people just have to start thinking about what they're asking. To make political change in America, you can't just change the president. You have to change Congress. You have to change the way we do business. You have to take money out of politics. There has to be fundamental changes from the ground up. But the idea that we can take this corrupt edifice that's called the American political triangle, and simply by lopping off the top and putting something different, we change anything. We change nothing. Change nothing whatsoever.
Just to wrap up this session, Scott, when you look at the bigger picture of the Middle East before the conflict started in Gaza and right now, how do you find it right now?
Well, what's interesting is, you know, under Trump, they implemented something called the Abrams Accords. The Abrams Accords was basically the notion that the United States could broker diplomatic reconciliation between Israel and various Arab nations to get the recognition of Israel and the integration of Israel into an overall scheme that promoted American hegemony, American control of the region. And it looked like things were moving that direction. Indeed, there was talk, up until the end about normalization of Israel and Saudi Arabia was an advanced state of talk when October 7th happened. But the reality is, go back in time. Go back to when the moment when Saudi Arabia started selling more oil to China than the United States. And then read the news reports, read the analysis and what that meant. That meant that Saudi Arabia was strategically committed on a path that in its inevitable outcome would be a withdrawal from the petrodollar. Because once you start dealing with China, and China's not going to buy into perpetuating the petrodollar, means Saudi Arabia is going to have to accept currency other than the dollar. And when China becomes the major consumer, so what happened here, China making this decision didn't happen in a vacuum. It's been happening for some time now. Turkey's been trying to be a member of the EU forever. And the EU has rejected Turkey forever. Turkey's been in violent opposition to many EU policies. And I say violent, take a look at what they're doing in northern Syria. Take a look at what they're doing in Libya. Remember that the Turkish Navy almost went to war against the French Navy a while back, escorting weapons supplies into Libya. Turkey is in fundamental disagreement with Greece, a European nation, fellow member of NATO. So when Turkey finally wakes up and says, we'd like to be invited to BRICS and look that way, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened because the EU has never welcomed Turkey into it. NATO, Europe has never welcomed Turkey into it. And BRICS is a forum that addresses the Turkish approach, which is a multipolar approach that has Turkey as an equal. Turkey wants to be seen as an equal. Europe wants Turkey to be this subordinated power, not an equal, but sort of a neo-colonial relationship. BRICS offers something different. That decision didn't happen in a vacuum. Nothing happens in a vacuum. History is involved in everything. And you take a look at all the decisions being made now. What's happened is that because of the incompetence of the United States, because of the pressure cooker of Gaza, that many decisions that were inevitable have been accelerated by the pressures of the present time. But these decisions, these outcomes that we're seeing were outcomes that were inevitable. There's very few outcomes here that weren't predictable in the past, even Israel's demise. People have been rightfully saying that Israel as an entity is an unsustainable entity, that the Zionist experiment is not one that can last a long time. What we're seeing now is because of the conflict that inevitable outcome is being accelerated, but it's not an outcome that was solely dictated by the present day situation. It was an outcome that was dictated by the history of the region, the history of the world.